Watching the progress of the revolution in mounting alarm, Athens' neighbours could hardly afford to take its failure for granted, and Cleomenes in particular had good reason to fear the worst. No longer divided among themselves, the citizens of a democratic Athens would at last be able to present a united front to their neighbours. The sheer size of Attica would give them a truly fearsome capability. Preparing for his final bout against Cleisthenes, Cleomenes could not afford to take any chances. No swanning into Attica with a few bodyguards this time. When, in the summer of 506 BC, he and his fellow king Demaratus finally advanced across the isthmus, Isagoras in their train, the two kings led a strike force formed not only of their own steel-limbed countrymen, but of contingents summoned from across the Peloponnese. They had other allies too. The Thebans readily joined the party by invading from the west. Meanwhile, crossing the straits that separated Attica from the long, narrow island of Euboea to the north, an army from the city of Chalcis formed the third prong of what now stood revealed as a brilliantly coordinated assault. But Demaratus, jealous of Cleomenes, his fellow king, had been fomenting dissent. Many of the Peloponnesian allies, led by Corinth, had duly deserted. Cleomenes, finding himself suddenly without an army, had been forced, in impotent fury, to abort the invasion. But not so the Thebans. Swinging swiftly northwards, the new model army of the democracy now faced its first authentic test. Accustomed as the average Athenian was to fighting in the train of a great aristocrat, would he now feel sufficient loyalty to a novel and wholly artificial innovation, his tribe, to stand in the line of battle? To cover the flank of his fellow demesmen, to fight not for a clan lord, but for an ideal, for liberty, for Athens herself? The answer, resoundingly, triumphantly, was yes. The Theban invasion force was annihilated. On the same day, crossing into Euboea, the Athenians forced Chalcis to sue for a humiliating peace and accept, on what had previously been her own territory, a huge colony of 4,000 Athenian settlers. Returning to their city, the Athenians commissioned, in the ecstasy of their deliverance, an immense victory memorial, a chariot led by four horses fashioned completely out of bronze, and placed it directly beyond the gates to the Acropolis. There, raised on what had previously been the supreme showcase for aristocratic megalomania, the intimidating sculpture gleamed, the first thing that anyone entering the citadel would see, a monument raised not to any individual, but to the sons of the Athenians, to the people as a whole. Athens' rebirth did not go unnoticed. Reports of her revolution had arrived in Persepolis. In the previous year, 507 BC, while the Athenians were nervously awaiting the Spartan onslaught, and noting with alarm that Hippias had taken refuge on the southern side of the Hellespont, in territory held by Persia, they had sent an embassy to Sardis. There sat Artaphernes, brother of Darius, the king of kings, ruthless and shrewd. When the Athenian ambassadors had arrived at his court and begged him for an alliance against the Spartans, Artaphernes had graciously granted their request. Naturally, however, he had set a condition of his own. The gift of earth and water. The Athenian ambassadors, shrugging their shoulders, had accepted his terms. What was a gift of earth and water? A gesture, nothing more. Or so, at any rate, it pleased the Athenians to assume.